Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Trans people and their very existence has become a focal point of British public debate over the last few years. They've become a football in the so-called culture wars. Despite the fact that trans people are a small and marginalised community whose well-being is severely harmed by the hostility directed towards them, often on a daily basis. The vast majority of that discussion, so-called, has firstly been with them excluded from it, and secondly, based almost entirely around negative framing, generally recycling many of the bigoted, horrible tropes long thrown at gay people, for example, being would-be sexual predators, threats to children, defies of the laws of biology, being defined by mental illness, being deviants, forcing the so-called normal majority to bend to our whims, and so on. It's been particularly intense, this anti-trans moral panic in the United Kingdom, while in other European countries and several US states in particular, the direction of travel has been in the direction of affirming trans people. Now, within the context of the British moral panic, the so-called CAST review was commissioned in 2020 by NHS England, that is the Independent Review of Gender Identity Services for Children and Young People, led by retired consultant paediatrician Hilary Cass. Its findings include that there was no straightforward explanation for why there has been an increase in the number of young people with gender dysphoria, that is the distress a person feels because of a mismatch between their assigned gender identity and their own internal gender identity. It raises questions about the quality of research into trans medical healthcare, such as puberty blockers, which are also used for children who have premature puberty, that is cis children, those who are trans, as well as hormone therapy, with therefore uncertain conclusions one way or the other to be drawn, raising questions about physical health, but also potential evidence about hormone therapy improving psychological help, advising caution in prescribing masculinising or feminising hormones, that while they should remain an option from the age of 16, that should be with extreme caution and a clear clinical rationale given for not waiting until 18 was reached. Now, the review has been widely trumpeted by those often hostile from a number of directions to the very presence and acceptance of trans people in society. While many trans people have pointed to the arbitrary exclusion of studies which show the beneficial impact of gender-affirming healthcare, the fact that in reality trans people of all ages are stuck for years on waiting lists for gender-affirming healthcare, rather than there being any hastiness in offering that healthcare, the inclusion of tropes and narratives associated with those hostile to gender-affirming healthcare of any description, the fact that the detransition rate, that is those who decide to reverse their gender transition, is extremely low, less than 1%, much lower than other surgical interventions. And in many cases, that detransition is explained, for example, by the impact of transphobia. On that, I've personally interviewed myself, retransitioners, that is people who have detransitioned and then retransitioned, who have spoken to that point. A big concern raised is that the report also undermines GILLET competence, legal competence for younger people, suggesting proper adulthood isn't reached until the age of 25 because of brain development, which would have a devastating impact, if taken to its logical conclusion, on medical interventions for younger people in general. Also, many other criticisms, for example, claims made without evidence. But it's important you don't hear from me, but from the experts. In the second part, I'll speak to Freddie McConnell, who is a trans man, a journalist who I've personally worked with at The Guardian, who I've learned a huge amount from. But first, let's speak to Dr. Aidan Kelly, Clinical Director at Gender Plus, a gender healthcare and education service in the UK and Ireland, who previously worked for several years at the NHS Gender Identity Development Service. I start by asking him for his overall thoughts on the review.
Overall, it says some, you know, there are some sensible things there that I kind of would have expected and probably would have, I guess, as someone who's worked in the field for quite a long time, kind of known, I guess, I suppose. And so the idea of kind of better evidence-based, holistic care, being able to meet all the needs of people that present to services and being cautious and careful with children. We're talking about medical interventions, all that stuff, you know, on the surface kind of makes sense, I guess. And I guess the worry I guess I would hold is, given the context of this, you know, the NHS situation in terms of funding and what can happen in terms of healthcare provision, but also in terms of, I guess, more so the political climate around whether people even, some people even feel that trans people should have access to healthcare at all, which seems to be a kind of a legitimate discussion that we seem to be having at the moment. And so I don't know how any of this is going to actually translate into making trans people's lives any better, really, I suppose.
Some of the critique from, particularly from trans people, has been, for example, on the fact that many peer-reviewed studies which are positive about the impact of affirming care, gender-affirming care for trans people, were rejected, not used in the study, partly because they weren't double-blind studies, but you couldn't have done, might explain why those, that's not possible. But in practice, that distorts the results because a lot of those studies show affirming care works, gender-affirming care works, but they're not included and that distorts the conclusions.
Yeah, I guess in medicine, healthcare in general, especially in pediatric care, actually, there's very rarely areas of care where we do have those kind of double-blinded randomized controlled trials, because it wouldn't be seen as ethical to kind of withhold treatment from a certain cohort, I suppose. And so most medications in pediatric care are used kind of off license or without that sort of evidence base. And so I guess you could look to another approach, another way of doing it, which the Germans have just done. The German kind of, I think the German speaking countries, so Germany, Austria and Switzerland, have just kind of released their kind of version of the CAS report, basically only a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now. And they kind of rejected the approach that NICE took in terms of setting the bar that high and in that way. And they took what's called a consensus approach instead. So they kind of interviewed experts who have many, many, many years, perhaps decades of experience of working this area, and I guess gathered a different sort of evidence in a different way, perhaps not to the same standard, but I guess a kind of a next best sort of situation. And so they went through a different approach because they recognized that if they went through the approach that NICE went through, you would end up with no good enough evidence. And so they took a different approach. And I guess they've come out, in favor of the continuing use of puberty blockers and sex hormones for those at 16 and above.
I'm somewhat alarmed by what the report seems to basically de facto raise adulthood to 25 based on science about how the brain matures, and that therefore having an impact on the ability of younger trans people to consent to gender-affirming healthcare. I just wondered what your thoughts are.
I think if that was to happen, the, you know, that would have to have implications for, it couldn't just be for trans, young trans people. There's lots of other big decisions that young people have to make in terms of healthcare. I guess on the face of it, again, the kind of idea of having an uninterrupted kind of transition or kind of pathway of care for those turning 18, 19, 20 into young adulthood sounds like a kind of a good, sensible thing. The idea that you just drop off at 18 and become an adult. And so I guess the idea that there's a kind of a soft landing into adult services in principle sounds good. It will require more resource, more funding. I guess it kind of, the things that we're left with, I don't really know what the detail of all of this will be. And will that, is what's being said actually meaning that we restrict access to hormones for those older? So they shouldn't quite say that, but I guess there's an amount left for interpretation, I suppose. I guess I can understand what people's skepticism about how trans healthcare has gone in this country for so long now. And so I understand why people are quite skeptical and perhaps imagine the worst when they read something. And so I don't know if that's what's intended. I'm not part of those discussions, but I fully understand those worries.
One of the other frustrations a lot of trans people have is the reality of being trans is that you're stuck on waiting lists for many years to get gender-affirming healthcare, whilst a popular perception often spread by those perhaps hostile to the existence of trans people, certainly the trans rights movement, as well as a lot of the media. The perception pushed is basically a young person says they're trans and then they basically puberty blockers are just forced down their nose or something. I mean, but that's not the reality. So what is the reality based on your own clinical experience? Yeah.
So the reality is, and Dr. Cass didn't labour the point, but did reference this in the report, that prior to her kind of review in being commissioned in September 2020, she looked at the data from JIDS in terms of the previous adolescent service that closed, the NHS adolescent service that closed last month, and compared it against its kind of international peers of doing similar work. And JIDS actually came out as the more conservative service, I suppose, compared to international peers. And when I would go to these international conferences when I was at JIDS, we always got positioned in terms of conferences as the ones who were more careful, took our time more, maybe even waited, delayed too long, actually. But so internationally, JIDS had the reputation of being quite conservative. So to put some numbers to that, about post-assessment, about 25% of those who would finish an assessment would ever get referred for hormonal treatment, whereas our international colleagues were referring at a much higher rate. And I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but I guess in terms of approach to that, but I guess nationally, the kind of the discourse is very much being around young people, you know, declaring they're trans in the playground and then being given puberty blockers after, you know, at the end of the school, you know, bell or something, you know, the idea that we are the conveyor belt of people going on to medication, which is not borne out by the data. And I guess in a way, it's kind of concerning to me that kind of narrative continues, even though the data doesn't really kind of stand up to that, really.
I mean, linked to that, you know, some of those responding to this review say, well, this was just a scandalous medical experiment on children. And this scandal will unravel in the coming years as lots of young people who weren't in a position to consent will say, look what you've done, who, you know, this isn't what I wanted in the end, but I won't be able to reverse the impact. And all the people who cheer this on will be damned by history. But detransition rates amongst trans people is very low, isn't it? And if you compare it to people who have, for example, various forms of surgery, or indeed abortion, the level of, you know, abortion regret, the evidence just isn't there, is it? Detransition exists, but it's very low.
Yeah. So obviously we want to look after all people that get referred to gender clinics, those for whom the medical pathway is the appropriate and right one, but also those for whom it might not kind of meet the needs that they kind of present with. But I guess we can't overly focus on one set over the needs of the other. And I guess my worry is that sometimes, although we need to be careful and we need to look after people who may later detransition or regret going down this pathway, we can't do that at the expense of the majority of people for whom, from my clinical experience, can benefit greatly. It's never, medical transition is never the whole answer. You know, the psychological factor, the social factors, feeling accepted and embraced in society and having all those other pieces in place are absolutely also very, very important. Medical transition can complement that, but to deny that for fear of getting it wrong. And I think that's kind of what feels like what's happening in England, in particular at the moment. There's a kind of, we've caught fear in a way, and we're kind of very much afraid of getting something wrong. When I guess the people who, and with the expertise and who've been doing this work for so long, I guess perhaps don't hold that fear as greatly as some people on the outside seem to.
Because, because it's interesting, because detransition is less than 1%, isn't it, in terms of longitudinal studies. In terms of just your clinical experience, sorry, just a couple of other things. Just in terms of your clinical experience, what proportion of people who end up referred to a gender clinic end up going through, for example, a medical pathway?
I guess that the proportion increases as you get older. And so I guess if a 14-year-old comes to see me versus, say, a 24-year-old, I guess you're... a 24-year-old, you can be more confident in terms of them knowing their mind and kind of having life experience. And so I'd say an adult kind of in their kind of early to mid-20s, the majority of those who come through would access medical treatment. I think younger ones, they might access it at a later point, but I guess you want to be, I think, understandably more cautious with younger people. So I think that JIDS data that we talked about would kind of be somewhere between the 25 to 50%, the kind of the lower side. It's not to say that they might not later access it, but I guess you don't want to intervene too early. You want to kind of keep options open. And then when they get a little bit older, you can feel a bit more confident in doing those sorts of things. And so, my goal is never around pushing someone away or towards medication. It's trying to think, you know, am I looking after the 14-year-old now, but also the 20, the future of them as well? Because I guess there's issues like fertility and different things to think of. That, you know, holding the option open for a while can be helpful, but also you don't want to, at the same time, you don't want to kind of put them through undue distress and maybe kind of damage their other areas of their kind of life and functioning. Some young people struggle to even go to school because of these things. So you kind of, it's not a nice, easy position to be in, kind of going, oh, let's just do this or do that. No one arrives at these decisions easily. There's lots of kind of hard discussions, lots of really tough thinking that goes on with the family, probably even before they get to see you. And then you're doing it all over again with them over a period of time. And so no one comes to this decision lightly, especially at a younger age, really.
I mean, one of the things that just as a gay man and obviously a former gay child, I read, just you worry about these sorts of tropes, which have been, to be frank, circulating amongst those who are hostile to healthcare and gender affirming healthcare and so on. A perception, for example, there's less validation for gay students in schools than for trans pupils. So basically this idea that there's less stigma attached to being trans than being gay, and these claims that people who are homophobic try to trans their kids. It's just, you read that, it's just so unbelievably disconnected from the reality of LGBTQ people. It's just one of the maddest things I've ever read. Like, no gay person, I really don't think, would ever really claim that it's harder to be gay than to be trans. I can't even get my head around it as a concept.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of goes back to some of those ideas around, you know, when it was kind of the debate around whether it was okay to be gay or not, with around like the idea that this was a choice, or people could kind of somehow choose to be that way or not choose. And actually, if they just did X, Y, and Z, then maybe things could be different. And then the ideas around conversion therapy, and that it sadly is kind of reared its head again, you know, in this country again in the last few years, around whether something could make someone, if we do one thing, you know, let them socially transition, that's going to make them confirm their transness or these sorts of things. And my experience is that first of all, it's unethical to try to push someone away or towards a certain identity. And adolescence should be a time of experimentation and exploring. You don't know. We want to kind of allow people work that and that out for themselves in their own time. But also, if you want to be really brutal about it, there's no evidence base to support that you could even do it, even if you really wanted to. Yeah. So not only is it unethical and harmful, if we're talking about evidence base, there's no evidence base that actually letting people socially transition, it makes them more likely to be trans, or actually that by not allowing them to do that, it's going to push it away as well. So, I mean, if we really want to talk about evidence, we need to talk about what we're doing now. And there's no evidence for the approach that we're taking now, but that, you know, so we need to really be interrogate this from both angles, I suppose.
Just finally then on this, in terms of where this goes next, I mean, in terms of for younger trans people, what this means, I mean, one of the things I've read, one of the points of the report about if a child tries to socially transition, then there should be basically medical involvement. I don't even know how it works, because if young people come out as trans, so they say that, and then they, I mean, I don't even know how that would work. They say that, you know, that basically means dressing in a certain way, asking for pronouns, changing their name, in terms of how they're spoken to. I don't even know how you would do that or enforce that. Go on.
No, I guess that's part of what I'm getting at, the implementation of this. You know, it would be great if you said, actually, I think I might be trans, or I am trans, and it would be wonderful if we could access kind of knowledgeable expert professional help, you know, the next day, and talk it through and think about it in a kind of a respectful, kind of affirming way. However, I know that's not going to be happening, and so by putting something like that in play or stipulating that, well, you know, not, that's just totally unworkable. And I think, I don't know if I'm quite right in remembering this way, but I think it was during that very short Liz Truss kind of period of premiership that there was an injection into one of the interim review there. There was something around social transition there that felt very much like politics and healthcare, where kind of the lines were blurring a little bit. And so I guess I don't know how we would even police that. Who's going to say to, what if a little kid cuts their hair short? Are we going to say what's going on here? And then it becomes, actually, we're kind of gender policing, or, you know, it becomes a bit crazy to think of actually how that would all work.
So it gave me some trust and nostalgia there. Just finally, in terms of, God, I miss her. Just in terms of where you think this all ends, partly because there's a review suggested in terms of adult gender affirming services. And I would just say, because at the moment, a lot of people who I would say trans hostile are jubilant. They think they've won. This is a great victory for them. I think they're going to be frustrated when they realize trans people are still going to exist and they will increase in number just because the number of lesbian, gay and bisexual people has increased in number because it's become, you know, amongst younger generations, what was once socially unacceptable has become acceptable and there's nothing really you can do about it. So they're probably, I think a lot of people think they've won this victory and then as time goes on, they'll see more and more trans people and they'll be, I think, a bit perturbed by that.
Yeah. I think one interesting thing as well to kind of talk about is that the kind of proportion of neurodiverse people is also increasing. So more and more people are getting diagnosed with kind of autism and ADHD. But also
ADHD, yeah.
Yeah. And so queer identities, LGBT identities are more prevalent within the neurodiverse community as well. There's something that goes hand in hand, and trans identities are no different in terms of that respect. Yeah. And so I think you're right. I think there is going to be increased prevalence. What these people are going to do or how this is going to react, I don't know. I think, sadly, in a way, this report doesn't really change very much because the NHS service has already been pretty much inaccessible for the last 4 years. It's now a 5+ year waiting list. I think I've talked about this in other places before. But the, you know, when the report or the review started in 2020, there was like about 2 year wait list. But you had a staff team of about 80 clinicians in JIDS and you had 4 bases. That whole team has been shut down. All of those staff have left. You've now got 2 bases with a total of 18 clinicians spread out across those 2. None of those 18 clinicians have ever worked in gender before. And you've got a wait list of 5 years. So when you've got people who are waiting even longer, the holistic needs, those other needs, are even going to be more complex, more embedded, and you're going to have a staff team or less equipped to deal with that. And so sadly, I don't hold out a huge amount of hope that there's going to be a quick resolution. And sadly, I always try to suggest to people who might be considering coming out or have come out, connecting into local kind of LGBT friendly and trans friendly kind of support groups and spaces are a really, really good first place to start. And then there's kind of, you can kind of link into local supports that way, counselors or other ways of trying to find support. There's our group, which we are kind of a group of people, of former clinicians who I guess would love to still be in the NHS. We've worked in the NHS for a long time. I guess we've been frustrated by the fact that couldn't use our skills and expertise in the way that we want to. We were meeting people, you know, after so long. And so I guess there's one independent service under the age of 18 that exists, but we'd welcome more. We would love to be doing more. We'd love to kind of have funded pathways in to see us. And so, you know, I think there's the small acts of resistance that are kind of happening out there to try and bring the sorts of care that's needed to the people that need it, really.
I don't know where they're finding that. I don't think, I mean, they'll just do that no matter what, right? I've been immersed in this subject for so long. I've seen this happen before where no matter what someone says, the people who want to deny that trans people exist will read that into it. They will find the vindication because that's what they're looking for. Like I actually don't think the report does that. I think on the face of it, the people, you know, I guess just as you and I know a lot about the problems facing the trans community, the people that are obsessed with taking away our rights and denying our existence know a hell of a lot about their sort of special interest. So they are seeing things that aren't there. I genuinely think it's a kind of hallucination. I do at the same time, I don't think Cass has gone anywhere near far enough in correcting them and saying, actually, no, this isn't about what you think it is. You know, people have written columns for the Daily Mail saying it didn't go far enough, you know, so I think that the headline, obviously, that's just the right wing press, right? That it's opportunistic. They will literally make things up to fit what they want to say, to fit their narrative. But at the same time, if you read a bit closer, it says things like, it hasn't gone far enough. You know, now we need to sort of say that trans children don't exist, this sort of thing. And the report doesn't do that. And And I don't know, you know, I think it should have done, it should have been more explicit the other way, is it, because of the times we're living in. You know, you need that explicit assertion that, oh no, we're not buying into this trans hostile narrative.
Now I'll speak to the brilliant Freddie McConnell and ask about the sense of vindication and triumphalism amongst those who are trans hostile. So one of the arguments made, for example, Roz Cavaney, who is a writer, poet, a veteran and trans activist, been involved in the trans rights movement now for many decades. And her critique focuses on how the Cass Review rejects an abundance of peer-reviewed studies which are positive about affirming care for trans people, regardless of age, including young trans people. So these studies show that they're effective. They do what they're supposed to do, which is obviously those with gender dysphoria, those who are young trans people, they get this gender affirming healthcare, and it has a positive impact. Now they've been excluded on the basis they're not double blind studies, but the argument there is you can't do double blind studies. So just explain why you can't do, why it is unethical, you can't do that. But why it matters that those studies have been excluded, because many would argue that completely distorts the research and the outcome by definition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I made reference to that in my piece that there's lots of stuff that she chose to exclude. And I don't think there's anything, the studies that are proposed are obviously have huge ethical and methodological issues as well, be it the where children are, or young people who want to go on blockers have to, that they're forced to sort of enroll in a study, otherwise they can't access that. And also the idea that the gender identity clinics for adults should release information about sort of 9,000 people that have been through. I've seen it firsthand. I know like what data handling is like when it comes to trans patients on the NHS. I've heard of like horrific data breaches that are just like normal, I guess, in some places. So I'm not surprised that the GICs don't want to just hand over that data. I mean, I don't think they particularly look after the data very well in the first place, but yeah, that seems unethical to not be able to, you know, get the people's consent for their data being handed over. Those things aren't the kinds of studies that we need, but I do think we do need studies. I think trans healthcare in general is very understudied, underfunded, as is healthcare of lots of, in lots of different areas for minority groups. So that, I think, is that's kind of what I was referring to as like, that's just a common sense thing to say. Like, obviously, we need more information, more research, more money, more funding for this area of healthcare. It would not be ethical.
The findings, though, because these studies, people, I mean, if you support gender affirming healthcare for trans people, then you would cite these studies. But these studies aren't; they're excluded from the report.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Do I worry that it distorts the findings of the... Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah, that's one of the biggest ways in which you see this anti-trans bias in the report. Yeah, I think... I mean, yeah, like I said, to me, it just seems like lots of sort of platitudes, like, you know, the recommendations, more services, more holistic, safer, What does that mean? It sounds like common sense. It sounds great. It, on the face of it, on the plain reading, sure. Like a lot of that is what the trans community has been asking for years. You know, shorter waiting lists, all this sort of stuff. I just think there's been I don't know enough about it, to be quite honest with you, to be able to say this is precisely why she excluded this and that. And I don't think she should have excluded this and that. Yeah, it's kind of, that to me just seems like a no-brainer. And I think just to go on to the point of like why it would be unethical to do a double-blind study on children. I mean, again, I'm not a researcher, but my understanding is that you can't double-blind something that involves children and young people, especially not where they're being given something that produces obvious physical changes. But yeah, like this is an area of healthcare and study where trans people are being unfairly targeted and penalized for this being a difficult thing to study. Because if you look at, for example, thing that comes to mind for me is like morning sickness when you're pregnant, right? Like I've been pregnant twice. You can't study people who are pregnant, so you can't say for sure that morning sickness medication is safe. But everyone knows that it is because it's been used safely for years. So that is a way in which it would be considered, you know, it's more ethical to give the medication, which is believed to be safe, than it would be to withhold it just because you can't do a double blind study. So no one sort of questions that for pregnant people and pregnant women. But obviously in this way, for trans people, it's being used as a kind of a stick to beat us, which is obviously incredibly unfair and a double standard.
I mean, well, a lot of people out there, let's be honest, I'll just forget the review for a second, but their view basically is a young person says they're trans and then basically they're getting puberty blockers just pumped down the throat like that. When actually the truth about any form of gender-affirming healthcare is that people are stuck on waiting lists for a very long time. And yeah, I mean, the point you made, you write in your article for The Guardian about puberty blockers, about, for example, in 2022, there are 378 children and young people eligible to be prescribed, very small proportion of people. So it's just that's not the reality versus the perception.
No, and this is something that at this point, it's hard to know what to do with this issue when it keeps coming up. And obviously, again, this is a example where she doesn't take the opportunity to make these points of how few children were being prescribed, how it wasn't rushed. You know, there are huge gaps, to put it generously, in the report around this kind of thing. And also, I mean, I think, yeah, it's hard to know what to say about the people, because, you know, we know this, we know how hard it actually was to get them, how rare it was for children to be prescribed them, how much sort of counselling and therapy and waiting they had to go through. Again, people I've spoken to personally, who I know personally, who I've interviewed, I never heard anything else. I think there was, sometimes you would hear of GPs doing a bridging prescription of cross set of like testosterone or estrogen for a much older, like 16, 17, 18 year old. So when that was, my understanding is that when that happens, it's much more likely to come from a GP than it is from GIDS. But even then, it's very rare. Yeah, I mean, my experience of the adult services was similarly that it was incredibly cautious. And so all we can do is keep saying that, and knowing that there are some clinicians working in this field who also know that, obviously, including, you know, endocrinologists, and who, you know, I think will hopefully be there, will stay there, and, you know, won't abandon their specialism. I would fully understand why they felt they needed to, but yeah, it's kind of, I think the most egregious thing actually that I saw in the whole report was putting that recommendation in the kind of top summary, this idea of like using extreme caution, I think it was extreme caution when prescribing masculinizing or feminizing hormones to under 18s. Like, that is an incredibly misleading statement to put anywhere, let alone on the front page. It's sort of, like I said, you know, chances are if that ever was to happen, it would be a 16, 17, 18 year old, because by that point, puberty blockers are completely pointless.
Yeah.
By the way. But yeah, she is sort of foregrounding it. And that's what I think, whether it's I just think she's, I don't know what's going on in her head. And I'm, I suppose a part of me is wanting what she's saying to be true, in terms of like, when you actually hear her interviewed about this stuff, she doesn't say the super extreme stuff that you hear people like David Bell coming out with, or like journalists, obviously, who are on the kind of turfy side of things. But, and you know, you hear compassion in her voice talking about trans people, including trans children. So it's funny because in a way I feel like, you know, all we hear about is how trans people are silencing the critics, and, you know, right-wing journalists are very, very keen to talk about how Tavistock clinicians were silenced and pressured into not speaking up to raise their concerns and stuff. And actually what I kind of feel might, or suspect or worry could have happened, like, to me, it seems like Cass is the one that's being silenced. It seems like she's the one that's under pressure. Like, if she really believes these things about trans children needing holistic, safe, effective, timely care, why isn't she coming out more strongly against the absolute extreme bigots who would rather take all of our healthcare away? I wish I could sort of ask her in person, are you feeling pressured to, are you feeling silenced? Are you, you know, what are you afraid of here? Because that's the vibe I'm getting.
One of the claims made centers on the question of young people making life-changing decisions before they're in a position to be able to understand what they're doing. But I mean, the point about detransition rates is it's extremely low, isn't it, amongst those who come out as trans and then have gender-affirming healthcare. I mean, the number of the detransition rate amongst trans people is in longitudinal studies, it's less than 1%. And actually a lot of that is complicated. It's, for example, to do with transphobia. I've interviewed a re-transitioner who made that point. They detransitioned because of transphobia and lack of support. Whereas if you look at knee and hip surgery, or indeed people who regret having abortions, it's much higher. Like, so what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the 1% figure is around sort of regret, certainly when it comes to gender affirming surgeries. I think the detransition rate might be slightly higher, but again, that is including all people who detransition, including people who do it for financial or social reasons. You know, that the percentage of people who detransition, it's like a tiny percentage of a tiny percentage, right? The people who detransition because they no longer identify as trans. Yeah, I mean, it's, we all know this. It's not hard to find. It takes a quick Google. I guess I take issue with the idea of puberty blockers being, you know, life changing in the sense that they are helpful and that they, you know, they do just, all the things that are actually true about puberty blockers have been so kind of undermined by the narrative in our media. I almost don't want to repeat them, like, because if you look at, again, if you sort of Google, if you look at it from an American perspective or an Australian or Canadian, you can very quickly find online like very kind of sensible, sober advice about puberty blockers, how they use for different reasons, and and they're called experimental, but that's actually, they're just, it's an off-label use for trans children. That's very common in pediatric medicine to have off-label uses of medication, because again, it's not ethical to study children. And it's, I don't want to kind of give any seriousness or credence or time to the, to these talking points, like, which isn't a criticism of you. It's just
it's just making that point about detransition is very low. It's worth flagging that, because we keep hearing people in the aftermath of this, well, all of you people, you're going to have to end up begging for forgiveness for all these people now who have had this gender-affirming healthcare, and they're going to regret it, and then there's going to be this big scandal, and you're the people who egg it all on, when detransition rates are obviously very low.
We need to bear in mind who is saying this stuff. Like, I've heard it. People say, you know, that this will be the trans medicine will be the biggest scandal since thalidomide, which is like incredibly insulting, as well as just being like wildly inaccurate. So, like, if Cass was saying that kind of thing, that would be one thing. But the fact that the people who are saying this have been saying this for like decades in some cases. So, like, yes, we can't ignore them because they're dangerous. Well, exactly,
there are people who high profile, and it's not to take away the validity of people who do transition, it's just the plural of you know, anecdote isn't statistics. You'll always inevitable. Whereas
they're
real. That's not to say that like, those people don't exist. Kira Bell exists, but they're not the norm. And well, sorry, they're very. It's a very rare occurrence, and also detransition.
Very rare.
It's also complicated.
Yeah, and she was like arguably, you know, the poster child. It wasn't. She wasn't just an individual taking the Tavistock to court. She was. She had a whole team of people behind her.
Your final thoughts, I want, is just because now what's proposed is a review of adult services. You are an adult trans person. What's your thoughts finally on that proposal and the general climate right now?
Well, when I say that, I often think I need to like sort of find the courage to leave this country. I'm not exaggerating. So that's kind of where I am, I guess. And I don't want to be one of those people that sort of, yeah, just says that and never, you know, because it's kind of it's an easy thing to say. And I guess it's fine to say, actually, because it's kind of a way of soothing and calming yourself down. And the idea that you could potentially do that, obviously doing that would mean being in a very privileged position. But when I think about it and sometimes talk about it, to me, it feels like a very serious option that I need to be considering. Depending on where all this stuff goes, not necessarily, it wouldn't have to get to the point of my healthcare or my hormones being taken away, but it could just be, it's going to get to the point where it just feels impossible to live in this country because of the politics and the culture and the stress. Like, it's hard to do my job. I've not written about this sort of stuff for years, ever since I had kids, really. My eldest is now 6. In a way, it's because I haven't done it for 6 years. I've been off Twitter for 6 years. That I finally feel able, you know, and also just like financially, you know, need to like make my job work as a journalist, to come back and then sort of dip my toe in again. And it's super stressful and draining. And if I'm not on Twitter, you know, it's hard to keep up with the conversation, you know. So yeah, it's, I hate it. I hate it here. and I don't want the piece I wrote for The Guardian, even though it's quite a kind of, the tone is quite sort of calm, and I'm sure some people will feel that it's much too soft on Cass, and that wasn't my intention. I guess that's just how I'm dealing with this moment. Mm-hmm. Like, people deal with it in different ways, and that's what came out. But the main thing I want is it's a genuine call on her to clarify her position and clarify that she understands that people like David Bell and everyone that he's around him and the organizations he's a part of, you know, clearly don't believe that trans people are real and that we should have access to healthcare that's equal as anyone else's access to their healthcare. So, yeah, I hope she gets back to me on that one. But yeah, I mean, the idea of, I'm almost avoiding talking about the idea of a review of adult services because it's just too much.
Thanks so much for these brilliant and deeply informative contributions. I learned a lot. I hope you did as well. As a journalist committed to giving a platform as best I can to those who are marginalized and demonized, as well as an LGBTQ person loyal to my broader community, I'll keep as best I can offering a platform to trans people and their allies in this deeply hostile environment. I would note how Britain is becoming an outlier compared to many other European nations. I don't think personally that will hold, but as was the case for gay and lesbian and bisexual people here in the past, and as it remains the case in much of the world, it will continue to be a rocky and difficult ride. Easy for me to say, but I hope the continued allyship of all too few people in the public domain, but there are those of us who exist who will continue to be allies no matter what. I hope we can do something at least to stand by you. Please like and subscribe. Do leave your comments. I don't normally say this, but it's a sensitive subject. Do keep them sensitive, if that is possible. Do share the video, get the message out. You can keep the show on the road on patreon.com/ownjazzy4 or listen to us on the podcast. I'll speak to you soon.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.